Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, in these days of the Trump administration, there are those who look and see what they believe is a rise in racism, in violence tied to racist ideologies or related issues. And people wonder, is it real? Is it tied somehow to the Trump administration? Trump, throughout the campaign, accused of not disavowing KKK people like David Duke white supremacists. And, you know, what's the deal? And so I thought, you know, let's try and get a perspective on this. Let's also try and get a bit of understanding about perhaps what the life is like of somebody who identifies with being a white supremacist from somebody who used to be, and I will emphasize the used to be. He's not anymore. Christian Picciolini is the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. We did a feature on him at WGN TV, and I've met him at another taping of a different show, and I just thought this story was so fantastic because of the changes he went through, but most importantly, because of the message he has to share, even though a lot of the early part of his life, to be honest, I find really distasteful, but I think he does too. So let me welcome him to the show. Christian Picciolini, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is it fair enough to say when you look back on those first years of your life during the skinhead days, if you will, you too have no pride in those years?
And that's correct. Yeah, I was involved in America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group from the time I was 14 years old until I was 22, roughly from 1987 to 1995. And it was a dark period of my life, but I've learned to take that experience and try to help others so that they don't go down the same path that I went down.
And that's why I want to hear your story. And by the way, you're basically Chicagoland born and raised, right? We're not talking to a guy. This stuff didn't happen in New Jersey. This was homegrown here.
That's correct. Yeah, I grew up on the southwest side of Chicago in Blue Island. And Blue Island was, in fact, the birthplace of the American neo-Nazi skinhead movement.
I also have to ask you one other time. When I read your book, and as I'm reading it, it was so close to a movie called American History X starring Edward Norton, which is an absolutely just very difficult movie to watch. It's just disgusting to watch the life they go through. Is there any tie between your book and that movie? Was there a basis to it, or is it just that your story is more common than we care to believe?
You know, I think the basis of Edward Norton's character was kind of a composite of several real people, with myself being one of them. It is very similar. A good friend of mine, Frank Mink, I think his story was used as the prison portion of his life. And then T.J. Layden from California represented kind of that portion of his life. But I do think that they definitely presented a very compelling story in a fairly accurate way. Life is like that in many parts of this movement.
And some of the violence, as I read the scenes in your book, which I found difficult even to read through, are that way as well. We'll talk about them. But first of all, you know, people wonder how somebody gets wrapped up in the life of a skinhead, how it is you come to believe that you're better than other people, that Jewish people, anybody not white, don't rake up to who you are. Obviously, years later, you come to realize that nobody's better than anybody. But back in those days, what I do gather from your book is that the way this may have started, you were sort of bullied as a kid. Is that what do you believe that's what sort of led to this search for identity?
You know, I was the son of Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s, and racism wasn't, the fabric of our family. In fact, my parents were the victims of prejudice when they came to the United States. So it wasn't, that was not the foundation. But I did feel marginalized. I felt, I was bullied and I was not accepted into the inner circles. I didn't have very many friends. So as I went on this search, this very fundamental human search for identity and community and a sense of purpose, I felt very, very powerless. A man walked up to me when I felt powerless, and he essentially promised me paradise. He promised me that I would be powerful when I felt powerless. He promised me that I would have this built-in community when I felt very abandoned by my family. And my purpose, every young person, especially 14-year-olds, are very idealistic. And I really thought that what he was selling me at the time was going to save the world. But, you know, initially it wasn't pitched to me when I was recruited as hate necessarily. It was the bolstering of my pride. It was, you know, the European heritage that I came from and you know, the proud Roman warriors and this whole idea of, you know, hero and being heroic by saving your culture. Then, of course, it very quickly turned into, there are people out there that are going to take that away from you if you're not careful. And then it would progress into those people that want to take it away from you, you know, they must be eliminated. So it eventually turned into this very large conspiracy theory driven movement that blamed everybody from people of color to Jewish people to, you know, immigrants to you name it, anybody who wasn't white and part of the circle. And it was this us against them narrative that, you know, we hear today, always about the other. Certainly, you know, the same thing that I was a part of 30 years ago still exists today. And unfortunately, it's larger than it's ever been.
But Christian, of course, you have to be susceptible to it. I mean, you write about how you used to sit alone in your closet at home and basically pray to God asking for help and saying, look, help me, and then you can take the day off. I think is the way you wrote about it. I also think about people today who can get wrapped up in this stuff because it amazes me how anybody can turn to a life of hate. But is that a necessary piece here? Is there that vulnerability, that weakness that, I don't think I'm going to make it. So you pray to God for help. And then maybe, I think his name was Martel, as the skinhead you were talking about, approaches you and offers you the hope.
Right. Yeah. You know, they're under that search for identity, community, and purpose. If there's a perceived grievance or a brokenness or some sort of a trauma, I call them potholes, you know, the things that deviated people from their original path. Is it abuse? Is it addiction? Is it abandonment, like was the case for me? Is it, mental health issues? It could be a whole series of underlying things and potholes. Those are the things that need to be addressed. Those are the things that make people vulnerable to the messaging of any type of extremist group, whether we're talking about the far right, the far left, ISIS-inspired, terrorists, or even inner-city gangs. It's the marginalization. It's the loss of hope. And it's the absence of opportunity for young people to really fulfill their dreams that kind of pushes them to the side and makes them a little bit more vulnerable to the messaging by these extremists who are promising paradise and very easy solutions and by blaming somebody else as the cause of those problems.
Your family sees this change. This was the part that kind of tied me into the American History X movie because it was around page 60, 61. You get your head shaved. You shave a friend's head. He shaves your head. The uniform comes on. The boots, which seem to be critical. The thing is, that look, that skinhead look that people know, it's almost a punk rocker look, and I want you to tie this to the notion of music because you're a musician as well.
Sure.
Later on, I want to talk about the fact that that's not how they're looking today, but back then, that was the look. It was also tied to music, and I believe early on, you didn't even recognize the tie to lyrics. You sang them, but you didn't even realize what you were really singing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a 14-year-old kid. I didn't know anything about politics. I didn't know anything about race. I didn't even know that, you know, racism really existed. But I started to listen to this really aggressive music that seemed to speak to me because it was talking about, the grievances of young people, of not being accepted, of not being able to get jobs, of not being listened to. It resonated with me. And music became probably the most important tool to recruit people during the 80s and 90s. There were bands from Europe that were making this white power music, which was similar to punk rock or kind of the non-political skinhead version that's called Oi. It was, aggressive music for angsty teenagers who wanted to meet with other angsty people. Misery really loves company in that regard. So, you've got all these really angry kids who are now directed directing their fear and their anger at a particular group of people. And you're putting them in a room together with this pounding beat and this alcohol that's flowing and the sense of community. And it's very addictive, you know, especially for a young, powerless kid who, you know, feels that nobody accepted him and now is put on this pedestal. You know, when I shaved my head, Paul, and I wore those boots that first time when I was 14 years old, yeah, I would walk down the street and those same bullies that used to, you know, beat me up or call me names would now cross the street and they would avoid me. And that was, you know, very powerful feeling to me. At least I perceived it as power. It was,
you weren't getting bullied here anymore.
No, I wasn't. And in fact, then I started to recruit the bullies because I knew that they were also broken. So I would appeal to them and find their vulnerabilities and then pull them into the organization as well.
But Christian, where does the negative be? One of the things you write is you said you wanted to do more than just fit in. You wanted to matter. That actually could be a positive motivational life philosophy.
That's correct. If there were a positive option at that time, I'm certain that I would have grasped it. You know, if somebody would have came to me at 14 years old and seen that for my whole youth, I'd sat in that closet coming up with inventions and drawing pictures and coming up with music and said, you know, you've really got a talent for this. Let's foster that. Let's, you know, let's support your passion in that positive sense, rather than the lack of that, which led me to this other person who happened to be America's first neo-Nazi skinhead, who confronted me in an alley one day when I was 14 years old and ultimately changed my life forever.
There's a mantra, I guess, to part of being this skinhead person, and the mantra being 14 words. You write about them. In fact, in the book, you kind of say them and you repeat them, repeat them, repeat them, repeat them. They're not dirty words, but explain to the listeners what the 14 words are and why they're so critical.
The 14 words is essentially shorthand for the mission statement of the white supremacist movement, not just in America, but globally. And those 14 words are, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And that's really the operating theory that the whole movement, the global movement, operates on. Now, while that might seem fairly benign, you know, what they really mean is we will protect ourselves at any costs. We will eliminate the enemy and we will work towards, you know, a white homeland and maybe even a white planet.
The stories of violence in the book are again, they're you know, interesting in a movie, I suppose, because they get people interested, but they're really very difficult, and especially when you're reading them and you know these are real. And you had one story of going into a McDonald's at night, and there's a group of four African-American teenagers. And when I say teenager, I mean it's one particular one you write about. He's like 13 years old. And you decide, you and your group decide, they don't have a right to be in McDonald's. Only you have a right to be in McDonald's. What happened?
Yeah, it was after a night of, you know, commiserating with people from the group and drinking heavily. And late one night, we went to a local McDonald's in the Beverly area of Chicago. When I walked in, I saw the black teenagers, and I, you know, very loudly proclaimed that it was my McDonald's and that they had to get out. And of course, we were very intimidating, and they were younger than we were, and they ran. And we decided that we were going to chase them out of this McDonald's. When the African-American teenagers crossed the street, one of them pulled out a pistol and began to fire at us. And it didn't stop us. It didn't hit us. And when we caught the individual...
Well, then his gun jammed, right? The gun jammed.
Yeah, after his gun jammed, we beat him... viciously to, you know, probably within an inch of his life. And it was one of the first moments that I was able to connect with one of my victims, because as I was standing over him, kicking him, and his face was covered in blood and swollen, he managed to open up his eye, and it captured my eye. And I just remember looking at him and thinking, you know, this could be somebody that I love. It could be my brother. It could be, you know, my father or my mother. And at that moment, I believe that I reconnected, at least with a little bit of the empathy that I had lost at 14 years old. And I felt very sad and very sorry, not only for what I had done, but for this individual and the kind of pain that was going to cause his family. It was a pivotal moment for me because, you know, I was able to see the humanity in this person that I was violently hurting. And it began to change and allow me to question what I was involved in and what I believed in.
Do you know, in fact, when I read that part of the book, I mean, I sort of wondered whether or not that kid that you kicked, whether he did live or die, because you sort of say within an inch of his life. And I didn't know. Do you know? Did he live or die?
I don't know. I would suspect that he did live because it happened in the neighborhood where I lived, and I would have heard about it. But and I'm glad that he did. I hope. You know, I don't know that I would ever get a chance to meet this person or even know who he is or for him to know who I am. But certainly I've spent lots of days and hours thinking about that person and hoping that the rest of his life was peaceful.
I don't know if he's listening to this, but just in case he is, you never know. Stranger things have happened in life. What would you say to him?
I would say that I was sorry and that I had no right to take away his dignity by a cowardly act that, you know, I thought was something that was fulfilling me when in fact it was destroying me. And I used that self-hatred to destroy other people. And I'm very, very sorry for not just that action, but any action, even the non-violent ones that recruited people, because I know that I changed the lives of hundreds of people, if not thousands, through the music that I made that may have recruited them into a movement, or the people that I specifically recruited that may have ended up dead or in prison or changed their lives, you know, negative ways. And I really feel a lot of regret over that. I've planted a lot of seeds of hate, you know, many years ago, and I feel like I'm still pulling out the weeds from those seeds, which is why I've dedicated my life to helping people disengage from those types of movements.
And that may be the most important reason for all of this is the change you're trying to create now. You know, some people might look and want to blame your family. It was the mother. It was the father. But the truth is, you had a loving family. Your mother was stunned by all of this. You had a brother who I looked like you called each other buddy. His name was Alex. Talk about that family relationship.
You know,
you came home with the skinhead. Your mother was not pleased to see what was going on.
No, she missed the, you know, the mushroom haircut that I had growing up as a boy that she gave me. You know, I came from a really wonderful family. They're still, you know, amazing. And if it weren't for support, I don't know that I would have made it out alive or in one piece. And they tried very hard. You know, looking back now, when I became a parent 24 years ago, I understood that they weren't abandoning me, that they were actually just working very, very hard to support the family in a, you know, kind of a hostile world to immigrants. And I recognize that now. You know, I didn't recognize it at the point. At that time, it felt like abandonment to me. But the truth is, you know, my parents are wonderful, loving people who tried very, very hard to dissuade me from going down that path. But, you know, I don't think any parent really knows once their child is involved in something so dangerous how to connect with them again and how to talk them out of it, because part of the reason why young people are doing that is for attention, and the more attention that they get, the more they feed off of that. That's not to tell parents not to try and intervene with their kids, but to just think of it, you know, in a very empathetical, you know, with a lot of empathy to try and understand where the child is coming from and what needs aren't being filled. But yeah, you know, and my brother, who is 10 years younger than me, you know, essentially when I joined the movement and he was 4 years old and I was 14, this close relationship that I had after feeling like an only child for many, many years with my brother, it dissipated because I was more committed to this external family that I had developed rather than my real one. So for many years, I didn't have a relationship with my brother after being very, very close with him. Because of that, I think he resented me and acted out in a way to try and get my attention. And one day when he, you know, was in his, when he was 20 years old, it was actually a month before his 21st birthday. He was driving in a car with some friends and was in the wrong place at the wrong time and was killed by people who were afraid of his skin color, who were threatened by his appearance, which for many, many years felt as if it was punishment to what I have done.
I was going
to
ask, did you,
responsible.
That's what I was going to ask. Did you feel responsible for what happened to your brother? He was killed. Did you feel responsible for that?
I did. I felt responsible for not being there for him when he was, I was essentially acting out what my parents had done to me with my brother, and I wasn't there for him when he needed it, when he needed that guidance. He was kind of going down a path that I had gone down, where he was trying to be respected, not necessarily in the same movement or anything like that, but he was trying to be respected and was putting himself in situations that were, not part of his DNA. He was, he was a lovable follower, whereas, I always had this drive for ego, and he didn't. I really blamed myself for that.
Some would say that a woman could never fall in love with somebody who was living the life you were living, but at first a woman named Lisa did. And Lisa, in many ways, changed your life because of what else she gave you. Talk about that.
Yeah, I met Lisa when I was 18 years old, and by 19 we were married and had our first child, and then at 21 we had our second child, and Lisa was not involved in this movement. In fact, she hated it. And did
but
everything
she knew what you did, right? How did she marry you?
Oh, it took me a long time, but she wouldn't even agree to go out on a date with me. But once she did, it was as if I had a separate life with her. When I was with her, I was calm and loving and caring, and I was completely different than the person that I was when I wasn't with her.
But were you in the boots and the uniform, or when you were with her, did we see you in a suit and jeans and looking sort of normal?
No, I was the same, and she definitely didn't like it. But after a while, I think she recognized something inside of me, and we fell in love, and decided to start a family. And that act of acceptance really challenged my sense of identity and community and purpose, because I wasn't, just a skinhead leader. I was a father and a husband. My community now was this one that I'd physically made instead of the one that I'd manufactured around me. And my purpose was to really, support my family and be a good example. And it certainly clashed with, this other life that I was leading.
But that marriage did not work. That did not persevere.
No, she it lasted for 4 years. And there was a compromise that I had made where I would stop going out on the streets and stop leading. And instead I was going to open a business to support the family. But my idea of opening a business was to open a white power record store to sell this music that I was importing from Europe. That kept me from the family. And essentially I had abandoned my wife and child because I was working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, the same as my parents had done. And in fact, this white power music became very, very popular and became 75% of my music sales. But because I was also, trying to be a greedy business person, I began to sell hip hop and punk rock and heavy metal. And what happened next, I never would have expected. But the people that came in to buy that music, who were African American, who were gay, who were Jewish, they came in there with a lot of compassion and empathy for me. They knew who I was. They knew what I was about. They knew what I was selling in the store. And they could have attacked me, and they could have broken my windows, but they didn't. Instead, they showed me compassion when I least deserved it, and they were the people that I least deserved it from. And that really was kind of what allowed me to fully humanize people and realize that the path I was on was wrong, because I'd never before then really had a meaningful interaction with any of the people that I hated. So I didn't know them. And that's the case for, 9 out of 10 white supremacists in the world. They just don't have access to the people that they hate. And they've got this fear rhetoric feeding them that they never actually build that bridge and make that human connection. And I had begun to do that at the record store. Unfortunately, when I decided to pull the white power music, this sales couldn't support the store and I had to close it. And at the same time, my wife and children left me because I just hadn't made the disengagement quickly enough. And
some might say, he deserves some of that negative stuff. Maybe you did. But life does take a turn for you and enter Britain into your life. And that makes your life almost complete, right?
Yeah. So, I've been with my current wife for over 15 years, and We met when I had started to work for IBM after I left the movement.
Now, I got to stop you right there. You just said you got a job with IBM. If I'm listening to this podcast going, what? IBM? Because we mentioned this, but you got thrown out of school five different schools. You never graduated. You don't have computer skills. What the heck are you doing working for IBM? Who got you that job?
You know, that's a really amazing story. After I left the movement, I'd gone through this depression, very deep depression for 5 years where, there were mornings, almost every morning, that I'd wake up and really want to take my own life. And I had a friend who, at the time, one of the only friends that I had, recognized that I needed to change my life. And what had been happening was that I tried to outrun my past. I tried to make new friends and move and cover up my tattoos. And I didn't want to associate who I was with who I was in the present. And she encouraged me to go apply for a job at IBM because she was working there and as a temp worker. And she said, just go apply, tell them you're good with people. And I said, yeah, okay, I'm going to do that. And of course, I wrote my first resume and I lied on my first resume and I went in for the interviews and I got the job. And of all the places, literally millions of customers that IBM could have placed me at, they put me at my old high school, the same one that I was kicked out of twice, to install their computers. I was terrified. I was completely so scared that I was a grown man who was trembling and sweating and couldn't even speak. I decided to go there on my first day, and of course, as destiny would have it, the man, the black security guard who I had gotten in a fist fight with that got me kicked out of that school for the second time, walks right by me. And I didn't know what to do, Paul. I couldn't even formulate words, but I decided I needed to do something. So I followed him to the parking lot, and as he was getting into his car, I tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned around, and when he looked at me, he was afraid, and he took a step back. And at that moment, all I could think to say was, I'm sorry. And after a moment, he extended his hand, and he shook my hand. We hugged, and we talked for a long time, and it's quite possible we may have cried. He made me promise something after I had told him, my story, and he made me promise that I would tell my story to other people, because I think even ahead of his time, he recognized how the story of just a fairly normal kid growing up in a fairly normal neighborhood could go down this path, this very extremist and dangerous and violent path to hurt other people based on this need for acceptance. And that's what encouraged me to start writing my book. And 10 years later, I finally published it. It was because of that man that I decided to come public with my story and begin the healing process. And I can tell you, my life, when I decided to start talking about my past, was incredibly cathartic and healing for me. And people that I told couldn't even believe that the person I was telling them about was the person that was standing in front of them. That forgiveness and seeking forgiveness and being able to forgive myself is ultimately what led me to the work that I'm doing now.
It's surprisingly shocking to know you went on to get a degree from DePaul. You eventually open a global entertainment media firm. You get nominated for regional Emmys for various work that you're doing. You co-found a group called Life After Hate, which is dedicated to helping other people work through these kinds of issues. And people can visit that at exitusa.org. When you look at Christian Picciolini back then from where you are now, do you know who that guy is?
I do. I think it's really no different than the person I am now, who is, still searching for, community and identity and purpose like we all are. I went down a bad path because I believed the rhetoric that I heard. I believed in the fear that was being instilled in me, and I learned to blame other people for that rather than to look internally to see what was really lacking. And I also believe that people can change. That was a period of my life that I learned a great lesson in, and I hope to be able to share that with other people.
When you look at some of the things I started by talking about, this movement under in the Trump administration and the white supremacy that kind of seems to be there along the surface from time to time, and some deny it. What is your take on all of that? You've got a very different perspective than so many of us would have. Are people who see this element present, are they correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are elements that are more than red flags. You know, a lot of people say that, you know, we were living in a post-racial society before this election, and clearly we weren't, and that's obvious. What had happened was so many of these people who adhere to this ideology or are racist were not accepted. They were kind of living in the shadows. And this election really kind of kicked over a bucket of gasoline on a bunch of sparks that already existed. And now we've got a forest fire. And while I think most people would be happy with, you know, pushing them back in the sewers where they were and putting the manhole covers on and welding them closed, I think that that's actually the wrong approach. We need to invite them out of the sewers and actually approach them with compassion, because I can tell you that this divisiveness that we're experiencing right now is only creating more extremism. It's polarizing the sides further. So we need to find a way to start with common ground and then work from there. But absolutely what we're seeing today, there are elements, dog whistles. There are policies that, could have been exactly what we said, except maybe the messaging is a little bit more palatable to the people. Certainly we didn't want illegal immigrants. We didn't want any immigrants in the United States at the time. We were very against what we called the Jewish media and what they're calling now is the liberal media. We called the global Jewish conspiracy that we believed was in control of all the world's finances and entertainment, and they're calling it globalism now. So they're using softer words to profess the same ideology that we talked about. 30 years ago, Paul, we had this strategy called leaderless resistance, where we said, you know what, we're scaring away the average American racist with our tattoos and swastikas and shaved heads, and instead we could be recruiting them. Let's stop getting, tattoos, let's wear suits, let's blend in, let's go to universities and recruit there, get jobs in law enforcement and run for office. And they've had 30 years to perfect that and to massage the messaging enough for it to be palatable to the average American who has a grievance. I think what happened in November of last year is the result of what has always existed in our country, and that's the underlying fear and isolation that creates racism.
You have a lot of tattoos, got rid of a lot of them, but you kept some that white supremacists, if they saw it, would identify with. You know that, but now they serve a purpose.
Yeah, I got most of, all of my tattoos covered up except for one, and it's a band of Scandinavian and Nordic runes that go around my forearm. And to most people, they're pretty benign. Most people wouldn't make the connection, but to people in the movement, they co-opted these runes and this idea of this Viking white warrior as their symbol of power. Scandinavian runes are very popular within the white nationalist movement, and I have several of them tattooed on my forearm, and I'd always planned to get it covered up with another tattoo, but about 7 years ago, I was walking down the street, and a guy came up to me and said, "Hey, bro, nice tattoo, white power," and I said, "Hey, bro, let's talk," and that was actually my first intervention, just sitting there talking to that guy, and that really encouraged me to continue to do that work and actually learn about what makes people more susceptible to joining these types of groups, and also how to help them leave.
And to continue to do that work is so important. By the way, I have to note that you have a foreword in the book by Joan Jett. How cool is that? You met her years ago when you kind of opened for her in the band. You were probably not the kind of person she would have related to very much initially, but she saw something in you.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a really interesting experience. So, after I left the movement, one of the things that I kept, that I held on to, that I loved, was music. So I started this punk band from Chicago that had played a couple of local shows. And one day we got a call that a band had dropped out as the opening band for Joan Jett that night, and asked if we could fill it. Of course, we were thrilled to do that. And afterwards, you know, I was in my depression. She saw me on the side of the stage and came up to me and began a conversation with me and asked me what was wrong and told me she really enjoyed hearing the band and was excited for us to play with her. And then asked us to do several shows with her as part of the tour. And that really was an opportunity for me to realize that, you know, life wasn't over, that there was more to life, that, you know, if I wanted to be happy, that I needed to follow a happier path. So she really gave me a chance when I needed it, and I'm very grateful for that. And she wrote what I think is a really beautiful foreword to the book, and she's an amazing person who is an advocate for social justice and animal rights, and I'm glad to know her.
You know, just to know where you are now, Christian, and the kind of work you're doing now, nothing will ever justify what you did and lived in your early life, but if there's any purpose in it, you found it, and the fact that you are doing good now and turning other people around and seeing life after hate, as your organization says, is so critical to society that I think you're making a huge difference, and I congratulate you on that. And it's why I wanted to talk to you, because when I, you know, kind of first was introduced to the topic, it was a turnoff to me, but then I kind of got it and realized what you've done with your life. The book is Romantic Violence: Memoirs of an American Skinhead. By Christian Picciolini, which I'm going to spell because people, if they kind of pronounce it that way, they may not find it. So it's Picciolini. Amazon.com, where can they check the book out?
You can check it out at Amazon.com or ask your local bookstore or go to ChristianPicciolini.com and find a link there.
Wow, well, there you go. So that's an easy place to check you out as well. And lifeafterhate.org, I assume they can also learn more about the organization.
Correct.
And what you're doing. Christian,
correct.
Thank you. Thank you for time. Thank you for your candor. You told me no questions were off limit, and I appreciate that. And I hope we made a difference even with this interview today. And I thank you, sir.
It's my pleasure, Paul. Thank you so much.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.